Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Castilea School in Palo Alto. My name is Denise Carter, and I will be your chair for today. We would like to welcome the listeners of WDPS-FM 89.5 in Dayton, Ohio, one of more than 225 stations joining us nationwide for America's longest-running radio program. It is my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today. Gloria Steinem grew up in a period where women weren't expected to become doctors and lawyers. They were just supposed to marry them. After seeing firsthand how her own family was affected by these stereotypes of women, Gloria emerged as an activist and has been at the fulcrum of the feminist movement for over 40 years. After attending Smith College and graduating Phi Beta Kappa with a degree in government, Gloria was accepted as a Chester Bowles Asian Fellowship recipient and headed abroad to India to study for 2 years. Fueled by the desire to write about her experiences, Gloria returned only to be disappointed at how little respect women journalists received in comparison to their male counterparts. Proving herself as a talented journalist was not easy, but perseverance paid off when Gloria became one of the founding editors for the New York Magazine. Shifting her focus to concentrate on the current women's liberation movement, Gloria did what many considered the unthinkable. In 1972, she co-founded Ms. Magazine, a feminist forum that has become a landmark institution. Focused entirely on women-oriented issues, Ms. Magazine helped raise a national consciousness and continues to be on the cutting edge of the movement. The recipient of numerous awards, Gloria has been inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame and is the author of several best-selling books, including Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions and Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming one of my personal heroes, Gloria Steinem.
Thanks to all the planning that has gone into this lecture, and thanks to the generosity of spirit of each of you in taking time out of your busy lives, and also the people who are listening on the radio. We have something very precious today, which is an hour or so together in this room. We are in a combination of people that could not ever have happened before in quite the same way, and can never happen again. So here's my plan. If all goes well, greatly aided by the fact that this lecture series in its wisdom has a question and answer period longer than the lecture, we will leave this room, me included, with one new idea, one new organizing tactic, one new subversive piece of information. That will help us make our own lives and the world around us better in the days to come. And in order to make that happen, I need your help in overcoming this old-fashioned structure we have here with you looking at each other's backs and me looking at you. This is necessary because of our numbers, but it is a hierarchical structure. Hierarchy is based on patriarchy. Patriarchy doesn't work anywhere anymore in this room. So I hope that because you are continuously writing cards, I understand, as we go along, you will feel free not just to ask questions but to give us answers. We could all use some. To make organizing announcements that you think this group and or the radio audience should know about. To tell us where the bodies are buried in some scandalous situation you know about. If you don't want to sign your name, that's okay. We'll read it up here. I mean, I'm leaving right after the lecture, so I'll say anything. And truly, to turn this into the circle it should be, so that we can see each other's faces and learn from each other. The subject is feminism in the 21st century. So I suppose that we ought first to address the word feminism. A great deal of effort has gone into trying to make it misunderstood. Rush Limbaugh, of course, is chief among the culprits here, since he has coined the word feminazi, which is, I think, especially offensive because it's ahistorical. Actually, the Nazis were anti-feminist and came to power specifically against feminism. But there have been other more subtle efforts, just as there have been to demonize words like liberal and affirmative action. So perhaps it's important just to say that it means what it says in the dictionary, you know, the belief in the full social, economic, political equality of women and men. And I think that clears up the first source of misunderstanding, which is that people don't know what it means. Obviously, women and men can and should be feminists. But the second source is that people do know what it means. And it does mean a major revolution and transformation. It isn't the way the world is running. We are not looking at the world as if female human beings and people of all color, as if everyone mattered, which is the goal of feminism. So, of course, there is resistance to taking away what is the world's single biggest source of totally unpaid or underpaid labor, not to mention the world's means of reproduction and the desire to control reproduction, you know, to decide how many workers, how many soldiers, what race, what class, what nationality more should be than others. This goes very deep, and that desire is probably the reason why reproductive issues are the key to women's movements around the world, whether it is fighting against female genital mutilation in many countries of Africa and the Middle East, or whether it is smuggling contraception into Ireland and into other countries where that is forbidden, or whether it is the fight to be able to have children in safety as well as not to have children. All the issues of reproduction are key. However, there are also other wonderful words. We don't have to say feminism. We could say women's liberation. We could say womanist. We could say mujerista. These are all good words that simply mean the full humanity of both women and men. Now we come to the 21st century part. And I think here we see, first of all, that we have to explain the length of the change that we're talking about. It has been going on for centuries upon centuries. This patriarchal, racist, nationalist system has been going on in various stages, ways, between 5,000 and 8,000 years, I think. The good news is that's only 5% of human history. Maybe we should just declare this an experiment that failed the last 5,000 to 8,000. Now, thank you very much. We're going to go on and try some. But even in this young country that we are, there have been two waves, so-called. The first was the suffragist and abolitionist wave, which took more than 100 years to gain for women of all races and men of color an identity as human beings. It's useful to remember how recently most of the people in this country and in this room would have been property, literally property, like tables and chairs. Having gained a legal identity as human beings, it's perhaps not surprising that it's going to take us another century to gain legal and social equality. But the first stage of resistance to change is past, I believe, mostly past, which is feminism isn't necessary. You know, women's position is natural. My wife or my employee is not interested in this feminism stuff. Whatever it is, you know, it's not necessary. I think we've passed that. But the second stage is with us, which is it used to be necessary, but it's not anymore. So it's declared over every Wednesday at tea time since 1969. As far as I know, there has been some article somewhere saying, or some person somewhere saying that the movement is over, when in fact it has just begun. I think that those are generalities about where we are. That is, we have moved forward in this first stage in consciousness, huge leaps of consciousness. There's almost nobody in the country who doesn't feel differently about what their sons and daughters can do. And we've made great incursions into the professions and even into giving greater value to the all-female professions, which is even more difficult than making those symbolic invasions into the formerly male professions. So, you know, we have made huge, huge progress, but we are just moving a barrier, if you see, or not just, we are moving a barrier. So the barrier that I would have experienced when I was the age of the students here, which was I could have just been told and was told, well, we don't hire women, or, you know, if you marry, you lost pretty much all of your civil rights, your name, your credit rating, your legal domicile, and so on. That's gone. And so there's more room there. But it's still true that when you have been in a job 10 or 15 years, you hit the glass ceiling, or you hit the sticky floor of the pink collar ghetto, which is still where most women are. Yes, you can make an equal marriage now and not lose your civil rights, and that's a big step forward. But when the first child is born, it becomes unequal again. Because, to put it mildly, men in general, though I hope and believe there are exceptions in this room, do not care for infants and little children as much as women do. And until there's equality in the home, there won't be equality outside the home, if you see what I mean. As long as women have two jobs, one inside the home and one out, there can't be equality outside. So, you know, we've moved the barrier, but the struggles are in a different place, but still very much present. If any young woman in this room is still saying to herself, how can I combine career and family, then that's a symbol of the kind of change that we need, because probably many fewer, to put it mildly, young men are worrying to the same degree about how they can combine career and family. And we don't have the structural changes in the system that we need so that all parents of small children can have a shorter work day, a shorter work week, can adjust their schedules to parenthood. We're the only industrialized democracy in the world without some national system of childcare, without some national system of health care, which women need 30% more than men do because of childbearing. So, you know, we have no shortage of things to do, even when we look at generalities. But I think some of the symbols and signals of the 21st century are with us all around us in the stories of our individual lives and the people we hear from. Now, I get to hear a lot of them because I'm accidentally recognizable as a symbol of this change. So people I don't know come up and tell me stories, which is a great gift. Sometime I'm going to do a book of nothing but what people come up and tell me to give this back. And it's exhilarating, you know, and it's probably a much better measure of where we are than the generalities. For instance, I went to get a bran muffin near where I live in New York, and there was a man in a yellow hard hat, you know, arising from a manhole cover. And there was a sign there that said, "People working." And he looked at me, "Gloria," he said. You know, I don't know him, but I mean, it's a good thing about, you know, it's like instant intimacy, which is great. He said, "Would you see that sign?" He said, "You know how long it took to get us that, I guess I can't say it on the radio, sign?" It's 5 years, he said. Can you believe that? He said, but now, he said, my daughter is an electrician. And she had to wait in line with a sleeping bag for, you know, days to get an apprenticeship. And she still, you know, takes a lot of back talk and a lot of punishment from the male electrician, but she's an electrician. I was in a bookstore signing books in Michigan, and a woman, very elegant African-American woman, came up to me, was standing there while I was signing, and she said, you know, she said, I first read Ms. Magazine in prison because I was a prostitute. And after I read the magazine, I started to wonder why my pimp was not in prison. So, I asked for law books. I asked her why afterwards. Apparently, she'd seen a movie, you know, in which a prisoner read law. Anyway, and she discovered that in the state of Michigan, only men's prisons had law libraries, not women's prisons. So she organized some of the other women prisoners. They got some law books. She started to try to help them with their child custody problems, which is a primary problem for women in prison. Their kids are taken away from them, often permanently. And she got interested, and she left. She finished high school at night. She worked at a women's law. Anyway, she said, and now I'm a lawyer. I thought you just might like to know. I said, are you kidding? That would give me enough energy for the next year, you know, just hearing your story. And those are the kinds of indicators of change that matter the most to me. It's the young woman who says to me, not what my generation said, and maybe some of us are still saying, which is, I'm not going to be anything like my mother, which was a way of denying that we could and might well have the same fate. Because if we could blame her, then we didn't have to admit it could happen to us unless we changed the structure, right? But instead, young women now sometimes say to me, I hope I can have as interesting a life as my mother. And they come up to me in after talks or in book lines and say, this is my mom, she's my best friend. You know, I so admire what she's done. I see how hard her life has been. That is a huge, huge change. And I see young women and young men who just don't accept the old gender and racial prisons. They just don't. I walked into a ballet class, and the boys and girls were taking turns lifting each other. there are, you know, all kinds of ways in which our expectations and, to some extent, our realities truly have changed. I think that last night here in San Francisco, and some of you I know were present, there was a great symbol of 21st century feminism, which was V-Day. How many of you were there? Just a few. Now, V-Day has turned into an event that is on 600 campuses every year that this play is done, or this series of monologues is done. In more than 20 countries, it's done by Native American women in Rapid City, South Dakota. It's done in synagogues. It's done all over the world. It has contributed $6.5 million to efforts against violence against women by the money it has generated. And this started out in the way that everything about social justice movements, I think, starts, which is just telling the truth about our own lives. It started out with Eve Ensler interviewing women about their own bodies. And, of course, because our bodies are the means of reproduction, we are supposed to know less about them than others. So just inviting women to talk about their own intimate sexual selves and just physical selves and take control of that and speak the truth about it yielded these immensely diverse, entertaining, tragic, amazing monologues that include everything from women who, from early date experiences or in Queens to rape camps in Bosnia to every possible kind of experience. Because she recorded women's real words and told the truth and reenacted them and did it in a as if everyone mattered way, so everyone was invited into this process. It has continued and grown from the place where I first saw it, which was performed in a theater the size of a teacup in downtown Manhattan, to Madison Square Garden, from a place where the New York Times would not publish the word vagina and she could not publicize the play, and even book publishers wouldn't put it on the cover, the word vagina, so which is why I ended up writing the introduction to help her get it published, to a place where it is now out there and open and has produced a kind of event that if you go to it, you're not quite the same person when you leave as you were when you arrived. That's symbolic to me of both where we are at the beginning of 21st century feminism and how far we have to go. Because what all of that money and effort is going into are groups organized against violence against women of all kinds. We are still standing on the bank of the river rescuing people who are drowning, and we have not gone to the head of the river to keep them from falling in. That is a 21st century task. I think we know what the causes of violence are, violence other than self-defense. We understand how deeply rooted they are in gender roles. Olof Palme, the former prime minister of Sweden, who himself was eventually murdered, was the only chief of state I know who always said that the gender roles were the deepest cause of violence. The idea, the normalization of object, subject, conquered, conqueror, winner, loser, that it's the gender roles that normalize that and that convince half the population, which is not guilty but is of inventing this but got born into it too, which is the male half of the population and especially men of an upper class group or different so-called superior racial groups, that their sense of identity, their masculinity, depends on control and even dominance and violence. That is the root cause. We have this around us in our own country, but I don't see it much commented on, that all of the serial killers and the senseless killers, that is, people who go into some public space and just kill people they don't know, not for robbery, not for stealing sneakers, not for any reason, except to kill people, thus the senseless killing, that just about every single one of them they are all male, they are all white, they are not poor. They are the people who have been raised to believe that they have a right to be in control. And when that feeling of right to control is flouted, then, you know, with other elements, there's no single element that's responsible, but that is the single common element, and then other things come into play, and murderers are produced. Look at the terrorists in our recent education on who terrorists are as we read our newspapers and discover who the hijackers and suicide bombers were on September 11th, and indeed who the leadership of Al-Qaeda, which is certainly just one of many terrorist networks. Who is this? They are not poor. They are all male. They are from the groups in their own countries who have been led to expect a certain amount of control. And it's quite amazing when you think about it, when you think about the relative suffering in this country and in other countries, who suffers the most, that they are not women, that they are not the poor, that they are not the most despised racial groups in their own settings. And yet, do we see this remarked upon? No. Now, I'm not trying to do a single factor analysis here of violence. There are many different factors, but this is the least remarked upon, I think, and yet it is the most obvious one. So it is clearly a 21st century task to look at the way the masculine role coerces and forces and ridicules men who are not in control, who are not violent, or who are not properly masculine, as you saw perhaps especially with Mohammed Atta's biography and the young man who came from Egypt, who became a terrorist. It's so obvious that it begins to drive you mad, doesn't it, when you're watching television and you end up throwing your slippers at the set saying, but wait a minute, you know, it isn't. Because the television commentators at the, you know, after a senseless killing all say, what's wrong with our children? It is not our children. It is a very particular subset of our children. And how can we humanize the gender roles so that humanize and eliminate the gender roles so that finally young men are raised to understand that they also have all the human qualities and that's okay. That yes, it's they're human. They're also gentle and compassionate and empathetic. They have all the qualities necessary to raise children, which is, you know, I think the key to it. If we raise, we've had the courage to raise our daughters more like our sons, which is great because there are more whole young women out there, but fewer of us have had the courage to raise our sons more like our daughters, to raise sons, to raise children, because those so-called feminine qualities are only the qualities you need to raise children. Empathy, patience, flexibility, compassion, you know, all of these things. And they're present in every man just as they are in every woman. It's a libel on men to say that they are not present there. That is a 21st century task. So I suppose if we were to examine the implications of this, these clear things that we need to do in the future, it would mean that we are overthrowing or humanizing. You can pick your verb depending on the state of your patience today. 5,000 to 8,000 years of patriarchy, racism, nationalism, which is a problem, you know, because obviously the environmental problems do not stop at the line drawn in the sand. You know, I mean, we weren't always organized by nationalisms, and we don't have to be. And I think we need to consider monotheism too, because when God looks like the ruling class, we're all in trouble. Most of us are in trouble anyway. We end up admitting that we're humanizing or overthrowing, you know, many thousands of years here. It's a big, big, big job. But if we look back and see how far we've come, just in our lifetimes, just in our memories, just in our ability to read and project that onto the future, we can understand how much further we in this room will see us go. And if we still lose heart sometimes, although I don't know how you can lose heart when it's such fun to do this, you know, and you get to see people reborn and change. And it's actually all an extension of when you were 9 or 10 and you said, it's not fair. Just hang on to that. But if you do ever get discouraged and feel disempowered, and certainly the minority forces that are still in control in much of our lives try to make us feel disempowered and that, you know, our vote doesn't count, we don't count, all those things. If you're feeling that, just remember that even the I think, toughest-minded physicist now admits that the flap of a butterfly's wing here can change the weather hundreds of miles away. Each of us has enormous power, and together, just us in this room, not to mention those listening on the radio, make one huge history-changing butterfly. Thank you. Could I come up with that?
Thank you, Gloria Steinem, for sharing your inspirational message with us. I would now like to introduce Tiffany Schlein, director and founder of the Webby Awards and a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, who will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you so much for speaking. I just have to say a couple words when I think of Gloria Steinem. I think goddess, I think fierce, elegance, warmth, sister, mother, father, guide, and inspiration. It's just amazing to see you in person. I think everyone wrote a question in this room because I go to a lot of these events and I've never seen so many questions, and they're all good, and there's a lot from up there, which I appreciate, that you wrote on scraps of paper. And some of them, if there was a lot of similar questions, I'm going to kind of bundle it together and make it one question. So, the first one is, does it sadden you that there's not that many men in the room here today?
Well, every man who is here is guaranteed safety in the upcoming revolution, so you should... But I don't know exactly how, in addition to students, this group comes together. So, you know, I don't know what it means exactly, if you know what I mean, how many men there are. And I do also speak to groups that are totally male, or unless they bar women, then I don't talk to them. So I'm not sure what it means. But I do think that there is a way in which all of us wrongly think that liberation movements are not for us if they're not named after us. Do you know what I mean? So I, as a European American person, am not supposed to think that anti-racist, you know, the movements are for me too. But of course they are. You know, white folks are in a prison. You know, I mean, like, look at us in this room. We could practically go snowblind right here from, you know, we don't get the richness of cultural diversity and everything that we can learn. We're in our own ghetto. So we all need to take that leap of the imagination, not just imagination, but looking at our real lives, you know, and understanding how much we need to be liberated from racial roles and sexual roles, whichever side of them that we are on.
That was good. You just answered about three other questions I was going to ask. is there a country that you feel is more receptive to the feminist movement than here in the United States, or one that we can look to as a model?
Well, there's no unpatriarchy, if you know what I mean. But there are certainly many countries that are far ahead of us. The Scandinavian countries are, Iceland in particular. Once one of the staff members of MIS was going to get married years ago, and we looked all over for where was the most equal place she could get married. It turned out to be Iceland. You know? Perhaps unexpected places too, like Eritrea. in Africa because they, as part of their 30-year revolution, the women were fully part of that revolution. They were 30% of the fighting forces. They were the generals. And it was a very conscious part of their revolution that female equality, it was present. It was absolutely present. But we could look at, you know, at other areas. Certainly we have a lot to learn about from almost every other country about sex education, about contraception, about child care, about worker safety, about, you know, there are all kinds of places we have to, we can learn, but I don't think that there is one country we can point to as a model in everything, just many things we can learn from elsewhere. I think also just tactically we can learn, you know, because, for instance, we in this country, the women's movement in this country has learned a very great deal from women's groups like SEWA in India and many women's groups in Africa that do what's called economic development, that is, the, you know, micro-lendings, job creating, small groups and so on, that we have learned from them how to do, probably because women are a third world wherever we are. What are the marks? I guess low on technology, low on finance, and labor intensive. That's us.
Okay, this is a compilation question of a lot, and I think this is from women of my generation. They did say their ages. It sometimes feels overwhelming at this point that there's so many issues, and is there one, especially maybe something that the Bush administration has done recently, that is there one thing that we could focus on to best further the cause of equality?
I don't think it's up to... We can't choose for each other, you know. I mean, if your issue is childcare in your life right now, that's the most important issue. You know, if you're not being treated properly at your job or, you know, that's the most important issue. So I think we each need to be the authorities on that question, and that's the strength of the movement. And then we can focus on things that are obvious, like voting. I mean, 70%, talking about learning from other countries, in India, 70% of women vote. That's because here we make it physically more difficult to vote than in any democracy in the world. So we ought to all concentrate on fixing that. You know, since you talk about the Bush administration, we have a president who's not the president. So... just for starters. But since we are in such a powerful country, too, we are in the belly of the whale, so to speak, the belly of the beast, what's the phrase?
I like the belly of the
beast. Right, anyway, whatever it is. And since there is a window of opportunity because of the focus, the accidental focus on, the women's movement has been trying to focus attention for 23 years on the status of women in Afghanistan, but it's now in the public eye. I think there is an opportunity because there I think there's a kind of beginning of the understanding of what I was talking about, that gender roles are key. If you have polarized gender roles, the more polarized they are, the more violent the society is, because they're conning men into being violent by dominate, you know, it comes together, and I think we've understood that. So, you know, support for the women there who have had their previous more equal status taken away from them would be key, and all the more so because the Bush administration is using them as a photo opportunity. Mm-hmm. The women's the woman who is the minister of women in Seema Samar, who is her name is in Afghanistan, has no phone, no office, has received not one penny of support from this country or this administration. Nothing, absolutely nothing. And yet was sat, and she had no choice, in the audience of the State of the Union address that Bush gave as window dressing. So, you know, we have to press. We could each with we're going to be paying our income taxes pretty soon, right? We could take $100 of what we were going to pay in our income tax and send it to the women in Afghanistan and say, "Come and get me. I think that you are spending my tax dollars poorly." You know, it's what we did in Vietnam. We just deducted what was going to Vietnam. Remember that? You know, well, you know, so we really need to take drastic steps because it's a very fragile situation there now, and they don't have much time to make a provisional democracy work.
What are some of the books that you're reading now, or the thinkers that you're looking to for inspiration right now? Is that a tougher one? You can hold on that thought and answer it a little bit later.
That's a great question. Well, one book I really recommend to you is called The Demon Lover, The Roots of Terrorism by Robin Morgan. It was written in the 80s. It remained very popular in other countries and has only recently been reissued here. But she could have written the biography of every single terrorist, you know. I mean, she did write the biography of every single terrorist. It's a wonderful, deep look at the why of terrorism. I would recommend that, and I think, you know, it will spark, a lot of thinking. And also, I would recommend a book called Exterminate All the Brutes. It's a line from Joseph Conrad in The Heart of Darkness, by Sven Lindqvist, Lindqvist, from the New Press. It is a slender, beautifully written journey through the Middle East and Africa, and it explains the roots of racism. Absolutely, it makes utterly clear that racism was a total artificial invention to justify the takeover of land, period. And that it was enormously mainstream, so much so that it was thought that it was almost merciful to eliminate certain groups of people who were inferior, miraculously inferior according to how much land they required. Thus, migratory groups were more inferior than pastoral groups in Africa, for instance. To eliminate them, to annihilate them, because they couldn't adjust to the future. And that this was an absolutely mainstream belief that came home as the Holocaust, having been perfected elsewhere to justify. It's a brilliant book. It's a really brilliant book. I hope you all tell me what you're reading so I get to know what to go out and buy, too.
Somebody write it down on a card. Although I've been handed another 30. I want to get to all of them, but I'm going to have an Oprah moment right now. A lot of people want to know, kind of a more personal thing. So how has marriage changed you? That's what you all want to know, so.
Well, you can ask me, and then you can ask the friend I married, David Bale, who's in the back here. So you can get books. But, I think the great testimony to our partnership, as we, refer to it, is that it hasn't changed us. You know, it's...
Do you call it a partnership and not a marriage?
Yes, we kind of started out calling it a partnership because marriage still isn't open to everyone. You know, we still, two men and two women still can't marry, so... And partners seem to be a more democratic word. Everybody says partners, right? But I don't think it's changed us, but I think it has enlarged the people we already were because we are able to see through each other's lives more things than we saw before. For instance, David is a great activist on animal rights and comes from South Africa and lived through that struggle. And so, because of him, I get to be a citizen of the new South Africa. I mean, is this reason enough or what?
Such a deal.
But I think it's more like not changing who you are, but opening windows in the room you are in.
Beyond Eve Ensler, who we talked about, and Oprah, who I just talked about, who do you think, as leaders in the feminist movement, who are some other people that you look to as striding forward?
Mm-hmm. Well, oh, there's so many. I mean, Alice Walker. Anybody who reads anything she's written emerges a better person than they were when they started, and with more sense of possibilities and more determination to become the change we wish to see in the world. Wilma Mankiller, who was for a number of years the chief of the Cherokee Nation, and I always tell her we should all enroll as Cherokees and make her president, you know? Gosh, there are so many. I mean,
any that we might not expect that, or you think we should?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, what crossed my mind when you were saying, Oprah, is that I've had conversations with several people lately, each of whom has been having the same thought but being afraid to admit it. And that is that, given the fact that the entertainment industry or the media industry is really the source of our political leadership, either because they start there or they pass through there, if you know what I mean. And given the fact that if you go to focus groups today, if you hold a focus group, probably a lot of you do this, and you say, who do you trust? The single most trusted name is Oprah. You know, why not run Oprah for president?
Well, that was my next question.
I'm serious. Yeah. You know, I mean, really. I mean, you know, and with a lot of, good, experienced people around her, but she has the instinct. You know, she has a good, populist, democratic, compassionate instinct that says there doesn't just need to be a winner and a loser. There's some other way to solve this problem.
That was my next question. When do you think we're going to have the first female president, which you answered? Or you didn't say when, but you said who. But time frame?
Well, I don't know the time frame, but I tell you we're desperate right now. I mean, the one we've got now, not to mention some of the ones, have removed all sense of humility we might otherwise have felt at approaching high office, I think. But I think the reason why it has taken us longer, I don't know how long it will be in the future, soon I hope, but the reason why it has taken us longer is also cautionary when in our thinking about who it should be. And that is that Thatcher, I mean, we got female leadership earlier in other places, as with Indira Gandhi in India, Thatcher in England, because they have a stronger caste or class system than we do. We do have a class system, you know, let's face it, but it's not quite as strong. So they didn't represent the majority of women or the majority of people. They represented certain caste or class interests. So if Indira Gandhi had a brother, it would have been all over. He would have been prime minister. But because the family was so powerful, it was okay, even though she was a woman. And Thatcher represented certain class interests in a similar way. So I think it takes us longer, but when we finally get somebody, it's more likely to be somebody that actually represents the majority interests of women and therefore, you know, the majority of the country. But we need to keep this in mind, because it would be really, it's not helpful. I mean, Thatcher destroyed the women's movement. And the first thing she did was to cut off milk supply for children. You know, it's not helpful to have somebody who looks like you and behaves like them. It hasn't helped African Americans to have Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court. You know, so it's important not to let other people pick our leaders for us, but to have people who really represent the majority interests.
It's another one from upstairs. The book one was also from there. How do you understand all the recent flag waving?
I'm not sure. I think there are a lot of different motivations for the flag waving. So I'm not sure we can judge that easily. I think a lot of us who came out of the 60s think of it as meaning something it sometimes does and sometimes doesn't mean. Because of a young man I know in New York, a young gay man, very liberal, smart, good, compassionate person, said to me that he thought this had allowed us to take the flag back. You know, so I think we need to be careful about judging each other. But it does worry me because it is jingoistic, nationalistic. You know, it doesn't make any sense since many of the terrorists are in Florida or New Jersey. You know, I mean, it's about being against violence as a means of solving anything. It seems to me that's the point. Not drawing a line in the sand as to where your nation is and becoming even more violent.
Do you feel that religion in general is a hindrance to the feminist movement?
Yes. In a word, yes. Now, I should qualify that because I'm using religion in an institutional sense. I'm not talking about spirituality, which is a sense of the spiritual value of each person and I think every living thing, and is often the motivation for many people who go to church or go to synagogue or go to temple or go to, you know. It's a porous boundary there, but I'm using religion in the institutionalized sense. And to the extent that it has been almost exclusively monotheistic and invested God in one kind of person and has declared other groups less than, or females or other races within their own religion, as in the Mormon, you know, all these different things, less than, it's part of the problem, not the solution. And I think, there's so many things to say about it. I don't know where. Here was one of the most edifying things that ever happened to me, which was that I took a trip on the Nile. You know, this classic boat trip. Some of you have done this. And so you come, in any case, we went from the most African, Nubian, oldest parts of the Nile toward Cairo. So you could see the oldest structures and sculptures, you could see that God was everything. God was men and women and flowers and animals and everything. And there were goddesses and gods. There was Queen Nut, who was swallowed the moon and gave birth to the sun every day. You know, there was the God. There was everything. And then you came, you know, another few miles. It was 1,000 years later, and God had been withdrawn from a lot of nature. And suddenly the goddess was there, but she had a son and no daughter. And then this, you know, you get on the boat and you're a few thousand years later and the sun is getting bigger and he's become a consort and there's hardly any nature. And then you, anyway, by the time you get to mosques and the most recent structures, there's no representation of nature or women allowed at all. So I think it's been religion has mainly been a political process of withdrawing God from women and nature in order to justify the conquering of women and nature. Henry Breasted, a wonderful Egyptologist of the last century, said, monotheism is but imperialism in religion. So, you know, I don't think we even know what a price we've paid for seeing God only in one group. And that group itself has paid a price, too, you know, that they are supposed to be godly in a way that is not human.
Unfortunately, this is going to be the last question. We could be here forever and not get through them all, which is so great. There was one announcement about a great program, a self-defense class, which I'm going to find in a second. So I'm going to go to this question before I do that. What was the greatest... Oh, we're going to be two more questions then, because I'm going to find that and I'll relay that information to the group. What has been the greatest accomplishment of your just expansive and colorful career? One that you're most proud of that you would think? Top two, maybe.
I don't know. All kinds of frivolous things cross my mind when you say that, like getting out of Toledo, you know, things like that. No offense to Toledo, mind you, but... I don't know exactly. It's really hard to say. I guess... I guess it's all the ways in which we posit what could be and move toward it, even though it never has been. You know?
Something in the future?
Well, no, just the process of doing that. The process, because we're continuously doing that. You know, we're continuously thinking of, well, this could be that way, that, but why not? You know, and then going toward it. You know, I remember, I'll give you an example, because I think it's the little things. It's not like one big accomplishment. If I were to pick one, it wouldn't be, much as I love and value Ms. Magazine, as you can see by that story from the woman, former prisoner, or the Ms. Foundation for Women, or Voters for Choice, or, you know, all the groups that I've that I'm involved with and care about. It's the daily acts, you know, that make the difference to me. And I remember sitting in a room with Carol Gilligan, whom I did not then know, with two Gandhian people who were lecturing. And the Gandhian man, wonderful man, was describing a situation in which Gandhi's son was anemic, seriously anemic, and needed a source of protein. And the doctor recommended beef broth. And, of course, that's totally against his vegetarianism, from which sprang his whole philosophy of nonviolence. So the Gandhian was saying to the group, here's a dilemma. You know, does he aid his son or does he listen to his own morals? And I could see that there was this woman I didn't know on the other side of the room, you know, and I was, and finally we both said, get another doctor. Get another source of protein. Hello, they're not just two sides to any question. They're 14 or 100. It's that in us, you know, that in the face of all the way things are, the bipartite divisions, it always has been this way, that says, but, you know, I think that's, why not? That's the proudest part, I think.
Okay, BAMM.org, BAMM.org. It's the Bay Area Model Mugging Organization. And Gloria Steinem, this was terrific. Thank you so much for speaking to us today.
I know you have all enjoyed today's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Gloria Steinem, co-founder of Ms. Magazine, Tiffany Schlein, director and founder of the Webby Awards, Castilea High School, for the wonderful, generous donation of this space for us to be together, for our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, part of the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.